Autopilot, the autopilot. Eventually it's going to take on. Eventually it's going to be safe. Maybe it isn't right now. I guess Elon Musk, you know, feels comfortable taking billion-dollar risk, you know, and somehow succeeding in a way maybe that he didn't quite anticipate, you know, how that can be. And I don't know about SpaceX, but if SpaceX is like a worldwide huge technology, you know, that it might threaten certain countries of people trying to create that technology also for their own people.
Well, I heard some noise in the background. If anyone wants to make any comments, feel free.
W-U-N.
Yes, Paul.
Okay. Sounds like my audio might be low. I don't know. SpaceX has launched satellites for NRO, National Reconnaissance Office. National Reconnaissance Office for government is a big agency. They make their own spy satellites, and they pay. They paid Boeing. They paid now SpaceX to launch these things. The difference is SpaceX doesn't know what it is. You know, they know it's a spy satellite. It's like a truck that's going to deliver a piano to somebody's house. The truck driver doesn't know how to play the piano, but, you know, it gets out of the truck and wherever it goes, that guy, you know, they're a delivery service. That's what they're doing. And they, by having a certain amount of successful launches, the government now has approved spy satellites to be launched by SpaceX. And they've done quite a few already. Back to you.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Yeah, the NRO is an intriguing organization. Almost no one talks about them because no one knows almost anything about them. No one knows what their budget is, although some people believe that it is the one agency that has a bigger budget than all the others. They don't seem to have that many employees. Most of them are contracted employees, third party. They're not civil servants. You don't know what they do. You don't know how they do it. You don't know how much they spend doing it. It's a fascinating organization, which we won't have the faintest idea about until, you know, a long time from now.
Okay.
Tell.
Interesting is that so much money is being directed to the research and development of something that is meant to spy and kill. So all of that idea of Elon Musk is great. We're going to be just pieces of information to be collected. We are already, but they want more and more and more. Although SpaceX, Elon Musk is helping a lot to Ukraine right now, giving them independent internet for military mostly application, and that's good. The future is human robot. Last week I was saying human animal, and some people were pretty much offended. No, human robot animal. Unbelievable. 200 years, Dr. Roy, 200 years. Only. There was thousands of years of evolution of human animal. Now we have 200 years. And look where we are right now. Back to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not a case of evolution, but it's a case of technology. Technological advances in the last few centuries is incredible to me. You know, I often say that this is a great time for people who are interested in technology to be alive, to watch things evolve at this rapid rate. But, you know, getting back to military, that's the point of a military. Military is not to maintain peace, really. Military is to blow things up and kill people. Hopefully that won't be necessary. You know, right now we don't live in a perfect world, and there are people who want to steal other people's land and wealth and property and what have you. And until we kind of get that lessened and limited and locked down, it's going to continue. Big countries want to be bigger countries, and they want to be even bigger countries. So it keeps on happening over and over again. People, inevitably, you can go far enough back in history when your particular group of people were on top, and you wanted to go back to that. Even if you can't, you can make up a prehistory. The Germans did it with the Aryan race nonsense. That's just what people do. The Russians are doing it now, that somehow their race is better than everyone else's and they need to run the world. You know, China kind of thinks the same. It goes on and on and on over and over again.
But I was wondering why China launched spy balloons and not a satellite, or take information with satellite. And I guess maybe it had something to do with our technology and this idea that they have to compete against us for something.
I don't think so. I think they also have spy satellites, but in addition to the spy satellites, they seem to think it benefits them to have weather balloons as well. So I think you're misunderstanding what's going on. I don't think that China decided to forego the whole thing of spy satellites. They're up there as well. Russians have spy satellites. I'm not sure even the United Kingdom has a couple of spy satellites up there. Just because you have a spy satellite doesn't mean you can't launch a weather balloon or two or five or ten.
But it's not a political thing?
I think the idea of a weather balloon is not a political thing. I think it is a strategic defense information gathering. I think discovering the weather balloon and announcing the weather balloon to the public is a political thing. Now, I think I heard someone in the background. Once again, let's be quiet for a second. If there's someone who wanted to make a comment, please do.
PhD, there were some others.
Okay, well, Jim, say your piece, and then we'll have a little bit of silence in case there's other people who haven't had a chance to say their piece. I'm feeling terribly bad for John, NQ1U. He's still on the list here, but it looks like we're not going to get to him tonight. John, I'm terribly sorry. Please, if you want, I'll put you on the top of the list next Sunday.
It looks like he's not there.
Please give John a shot. I think this is a good stuff we're talking about, but we could yield.
Well, let me just try once again. I got the feeling that maybe John had left us. You know, he's looking at the clock and such. So, John, NQ1U, if you're out there, please respond. I mean, that's the unfortunate along one particular question is going to go round and round and round. So before we get back to you, Wesley, I think Jim wanted to say something on the subject.
And I got wrapped up in John and I stumbled and I'm feeling pretty stupid right now. But so go on to the next step and I'll catch up. I hate when that happens. This is a really interesting conversation. I'm glad you're able to entertain it. I'm going to let it pass to the next.
Okay. I mean, any subject is open as long as the FCC allows it. You know, I don't want to upset anyone. I don't want to give them offers. Before we get back to you, Wesley, I just want to make sure that there's no one else in the background. We kept on getting stepped on. So if you're out there and you've been trying to kind of put your two cents worth into this conversation, this is your opportunity. Hit the push to talk button. Well, back to you, Wesley, then.
W-A-2-C-D-O.
Yes, Andy?
I just want to make a correction, if I can.
Okay.
I said before on the 2 meter sideband frequency, 140, I think I said 144.29. I meant to say 145.29 for Jim. To correct that, 145.29, and I said 144, so my mistake.
Okay, very good. Jim got that.
Is that a legitimate frequency for a sideband operation? I'm tuning to it right now.
Yeah, I can actually work you on sideband, yes. It's legitimate because I've heard QSOs on that.
I'm there. I don't know if it'll work, but thank you. I'm back tonight.
Okay, one more question while I have the mic, Roy.
Sure.
Is it okay if I give people... I want to do another Andy's Corner, and it's kind of like spur of the moment. Not tonight. Spur of the moment thing. But can I give people a homework assignment to think about something, and then we'll have a discussion about it?
Sure. Do you want it at the very, very end? Because a lot of people kind of go to sleep towards the very, very end. So do you want to give it now?
I can mention it now because it's sort of controversial, but it's something to ponder. It's a good question.
Okay, give it to us then.
Okay, if you don't mind, it has to do with electricity. Something very basic, but something that we probably don't think about. So here's the question, and I'm not going to give the answer, because the answer is controversial, but we can talk about it. And it is, actually next week I'm not going to be here because I'll be in Florida. That's right, it'll be 2 weeks. But here's the question, does electric current flow from positive to negative or from negative to positive? And you've probably heard this question many times, but the answer is very interesting, and how and what the actual answer is interesting, but I won't give the answer until we discuss it, because I was thinking about how electricity flows and what is electricity. Something very basic that we use, but we don't think about. So that's the question, Roy, and we can have a discussion about it, you know, next time.
Okay, very good. I will send you a couple of links to Veritas and elsewhere, because there was a lot of activity on a subject pretty much identical to this. So I'll send it off to you.
I had a feeling there would be. And if I can add one more thing, I'd like to.
Sure.
The question is, how does electricity flow in a piece of wire? And if it leads to, what is the difference between current and voltage? So here's an experiment. If I take a piece of wire and stretch it out for exactly 1 mile, which is a little over, you know, 5,200 feet, and I connect a battery to one end of the wire, and I connect the meter to the other end of the wire, so I can measure the voltage, I can see what the voltage is, how long does it take for that meter, the instant, to the microseconds, the instant that battery or voltage source is applied, I shouldn't say applied, connected to the wire, how long does it take for that voltage to appear at the end of the wire? And the surprising answer, you think that current flows at the speed of light? Yes and no. So it's to be discussed.
PhD with a possible answer.
Okay, Jim. I mean, once again, keep in mind, we've kind of come across this question and pounded it repeatedly, and like I said, I will put up I'll also put up the link, but I'll send Andy the links to this kind of question, and a lot of people had a lot of opinions and talked a lot about it. But sure, Jim, give us your view.
I'm all in my head here, working without it, but I'm going to say it's instantaneous, as if it was hydraulic, fluid in, fluid out, and nobody can explain exactly why it goes that way. What do you think, Andy?
Okay, now, I just derailed the whole subject you guys are talking about, so I'll let you go right back to it. We will discuss it when I come back from my trip in 2 weeks. But the question is, you know, what is the definition of instantaneous? You can go deeper into it, and then deeper and deeper and deeper, like that. So, yeah, it's instantaneous, but by what means? Anyway, not to continue this, since I just had the floor, I wanted to add that in. You guys go back to what you were talking about, and we'll talk about this in the future. And Roy, thanks. You'll send me the stuff, the links, and we'll talk about it. See you later. WHCDL, let you go back.
Yes, Wesley recognized. Let me make sure I have the repeater. Oh, good, I have the repeater. I just want to point out to Jim, with the exception of the weirdness of entangled particles, nothing happens instantaneously. Everything requires some degree of time. Causality, cause and effect, travels through space-time at the speed of light in a vacuum. Now, in our senses, something that happens very quickly, 2 feet away, you cannot perceive that it's happening at the speed of light in a vacuum. It seems to us to be instantaneous because of our limitations of sensing time. But again, the only thing that happens confusingly other than entanglement is not instantaneous. There's always an inherent causality delay to get from one point to another in space-time.
That's fair enough.
To give up on it because it was related
to what we
preference.
Know. And what we know is
most barriers in open circuit.
We know
very
lots of things through
there.
The years.
Convention, right? Conventional current flows from positive to negative and electronic flow. Current flows the other way around. But that's a convention. There was a discussion between me and Dr. Roy about it, and actually we stopped it. Hey, Dr. Roy.
Yes, well, it was very interesting is that we have another case of Eustace talking on Glen Oaks, Jim, I think, talking on Selden, and because it's a duplex connection, I could hear both of your conversations, and I appreciate what you said, Jim, by the way. I agree with you. We talked about it, that we had kind of discussed it. But it sounds like Andy has a different angle to look at, and I'm not quite sure if he saw the same videos that we both saw. So getting his reaction to them and some kind of explanation and some kind of discussion might be interesting.
Anyhow, we have a few minutes left. I would like to just wrap it up.
Sure. Feel free to wrap it up.
Okay, so we were talking about some object that is small, it's heavy, and it's dropped from high up from the sky, and it can do a lot of damage. Then when we take the simple thought experiment, should that be one? Okay, we put left hand with the palm of the hand horizontally up, and we take the finger, index finger from the other hand, and we try to push in the middle of that palm. And all we feel is just the pressure, nothing more. But then we replace that finger with the needle, and the needle goes from the other side of the hand. So we say, okay, The small area, the needle is thin, and the same force is making the needle go through the hand. But then, we can say, is it true? Because the needle needs a lot of less force to do the same. And then we could go to the particle physics. Back to you.
I am not quite sure what you are alluding to. Objects have breaking points. If you apply a force, if you apply a given force over a wide area, it's less effective. As you narrow it, it becomes much more effective, and eventually you reach a point where the force per unit area is high enough to break the bonds that bind the material together. So, it's increasing the mass of an object, increasing its momentum, and decreasing its surface area interface will cause things to penetrate thicker and larger defenses. So that's just the way projectiles tend to work.
I'm trying to eliminate speed and see what happened. What if we have a half of that speed? What if we have a quarter of that speed? Remember that the sandcastle, barely damaged? Is the speed important or is the size important? So, by that, we could actually look at the likelihood of particular interaction between incident and neutron and target nucleus. We know that the neutron, a fast neutron, has a mega electron volt energy, and the same neutron, but slow, is less than one electron volt, not kiloelectron, less than one electron volt energy, and that's what makes the trick. That's why we have nuclear power, because it's slow. So it's slow, and now can interact with the nucleus. If it's fast, can shoot your body and not even interact with anything, because the space between the atoms and the particles in the atomic structure is so big that this thousands or millions of those electrons could simply shoot your body and do nothing with it, and we don't have the electron neutron activation. They agree with me.
I think you're kind of flying away at a tangent. Basically, the underlying principle is that you're dealing with energy. The more the velocity, the more the momentum, the more the energy. So that's what it really comes down to. It's a certain amount of energy expenditure. Now, if you spread it out to a wide surface area, it's going to have less destructive effect than if you put it into a very, very tight. But it's the mass and it's the velocity. E squared equals PC squared. If you extend the entire energy momentum relationship, you have to put the MC squared in too, but we're not talking about mass energy. We're just talking about kinetic energy, which is PC squared. So that's really what's going on with these projectiles. By increasing their speed, or increasing their mass, you're increasing their momentum, which is ultimately increasing their energy carrying capacity.
If I can mix the classical physics into it, if you're driving slow, you can turn left or right, you can make a maneuver. When the speed increases, the likely hood of hitting the target is very much lower. You may hit any target, but not the target that you want. So let's say if your target is open road, you may actually end up in the corner of the next building. And to actually.
Well, I mean, the lower the kinetic energy of the object, the easier it is to change its vector direction. But Jim wanted to say something, so Jim, what do you have to say?
Very interesting topic, and we're talking about the projectile mostly, but I'm going to talk about the target for a minute. Sand is a very interesting thing, and sand castles are a more interesting thing, and sand dunes are infinitely more interesting. And they're totally different structures. And you guys can probably correct me, because I'm going to mix two terms, and I forget which one is which. You'll correct me. It'll be good. So you take sand and put it in your hand, and you throw some water in there, and some bonding happens among the atomic structures that are in your hand. There's covalent bonding that happens and ionic bonding that happens between the molecules of sand and the grains of sand in your hand. And if you look at a sand dune, I believe that that's the covalent bonding. You guys are correct me. And it's a pretty solid structure. And when you see people try to rebuild sand dunes with a bulldozer, it doesn't work at all. At all. It's completely useless. Because there's a whole different atomic structure happening, and it doesn't work. So when we're talking about evaluating how different things interact with sand, sand isn't just a thing. There's at least two different versions of sand. There's probably a million different versions, but there's at least those two versions. So consider that in the conversation. And it's a good conversation.
Okay, let me make sure I have the repeater. I would think those bonds are hydrogen bonds. You're not really exchanging electrons. You're not producing ions. You're basically just kind of coating the sand granules in water, and the hydrogen bonding of water molecules probably causes the sand to stick together that way.
Yes, I have no argument with what your description is. But anybody that's actually, surf fished on the winter beach and seen the difference between the sand thrown up by a bulldozer or kid shovel versus what nature does in its slow-layered approach recognizes that something's going on. And the technological description seems to be what I'm talking about. I don't know the whole story, but my point is it's another great science to be explored. And so blasting rods of God into the sand, I don't think is something that shouldn't be considered. These things should be calculated into the discussion. Just my thought.
Okay, I mean, material science, again, is a very interesting field. There was an article that I cited in my link page either last week or the week before, I think it was last week, of a new type of amorphous ice crystal. What they did was they took water, they froze it, they brought it down to some ridiculous thing like minus 270 degrees centigrade, and then they put in a lot of ball bearings and move them around and bash the ice, and it became an amorphous material that acted a lot like liquid water, but it was solid. It was kind of a powdery substance. So there is a lot of material science out there that is yet to be discovered. Wesley, I think we should wrap this up because I'm really feeling bad about delaying Space Nest report.
Okay. So a few words. We're still talking about the missiles and the Veritasium experiment. I was trying to eliminate speed and eventually get to the point where speed is not as much important as the size of the projectile. If we talk about the classical physics, we can also use that analogy to the quantum mechanics. But if we say that when the projectile hits the target, then there is an effect, we may say that this is kind of identical or similar or compatible with neutron activation, which is the process in which neutron radiation induces radioactivity in the materials that occurs when atomic nuclei capture the free neutrons becoming heavier and entering excited states. The same story we have with the electrons. When the electrons get a lot of more energy, they actually jump up to the next shell or jump out from the atom. So we talk about a specific mechanism and trying to see what are the components ruling with the results. So, because we don't have much time, thank you very much, and I appreciate it. Back to you.
Okay, I mean, we could bring it up next week or sometime in the future. The problem, though, is that I think you're alluding to the fact that if you have thermal neutrons, they run fast. So theoretically, well, that should be more effective because they have more kinetic energy. But in quantum mechanics, it doesn't work that way. They whiz right past. Rather than get captured by the nucleus. So you want to slow down the fast neutrons in order to have a velocity slow enough so that they can be captured by the nucleus and do their magic to change the material from one isotope to a less stable one. Anyway, we will table that for the time being because I'm feeling incredibly guilty about delaying the SpaceNet report, so please pull WS2N. Please give us the SpaceNet report.
Okay, Roy, great topics tonight, anyway. ACTGS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Name here is Paul. And I'll go through a couple of things I wrote down. One of the things about the balloon, we'll get to that in a minute. Usually I cover the launches and landings first. Japan is going to launch a new rocket called the H-3 on this coming Saturday. They've had the H-2A and the H-2B that they've been launching for many years. And this is a newer version of the same thing. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And then they could run solid boosters to assist it. Either two or four. In this case, the first one they're going to do is two. Two solid boosters will help it get off the launch pad. Now, this is important as far as I'm concerned because the International Space Station has a lot of cargo vehicles that go to the space station. And, you know, we have the Antares rocket that launches the Cygnus cargo vehicle. We have SpaceX, of course, with the with their cargo vehicle, and Progress is another one from Russia. And for years we had the HTV, they call it Japanese cargo vehicle. Roughly once a year they launched an HTV, which carried the most cargo out of any of them. Space station, everything from food to science supplies to gigantic batteries, the space station. They decided that they were going to have an upgraded version of their cargo vehicle at the same time that they were going to build this new rocket, which is less expensive to launch. Everybody's competing against SpaceX. They wanted to drive their prices down, so they developed a less expensive engine, more power, but it's going to be cheaper to launch. So it'd be good to see that launch pad on Saturday. The new HTV that they will be eventually launching to the space station also has the capability of going to the new space station, the Gateway, once that's put into lunar orbit. So, of course, that's quite a few years off. But that's their plan. So they signed up with us help explore the moon in the not too distant. Another launch that's coming up is another Progress vehicle, also couple of days, February 9th, so, what, 3 days away, to resupply the space station with stuff. They have plans on the 20th of sending another unmanned vehicle to the space station, but that's to try to solve the problem with the leaking manned crewed vehicle that's attached to the space station at this time. That's going to replace that one. And it's a process, you know. They'll eventually send the same crew that came up down on that vehicle. And then the old one, they'll bring the old one back unmanned. And that'll land in Kazakhstan just like the other crew vehicle. So we'll see how Russia does with that. Yeah, first thing on my list was going to be about the balloon, but we pretty much covered that. The Pentagon, of course, is heavily involved in investigating what that thing was doing. One of the things I didn't hear anybody bring up was the jamming that probably went on by our government to make sure that as this thing flew over over our country, none of it was being transmitted back to China. And I heard stories about having cameras on board taking pictures. They have cameras on spy satellites that are just fantastic and very reliable. They go over the same spot every day. They can take just terrific pictures. Most likely, what I think anyway, is that the balloon is probably trying to pick up signals from Earth, you know, radio signals, trying to figure out, our government transmissions and military transmissions, and they're probably trying to copy that, transmitting that information back, trying to figure out maybe try to decode with it what we're talking to one another about. And, my guess, that's probably what they were trying to do, probably more of a radio receiver and transmitter than anything else. And I'm sure that we have the capability of jamming anything that got out of there. And as far as knocking it down early on, they knew it was flying at 60,000 feet, and this heavy payload that they're carrying was probably going to be spread over a large area, and they didn't want to take the chance of hitting something. They didn't even want to hit a cow, never mind people or a house. And then it proved the point when they did break it apart at 60,000 feet over water. It's now taking up 7 acres of land, so I think it'll make maybe 3 by 3 miles, big footprint in the ocean. But of course, that probably didn't hit anything, and probably no boats floating out there that got hit. Thought I'd bring that up. Let me drop it. Okay, now Roy had sent me a question by Alex, 882DU, but I don't know if he's on frequency. I didn't hear him tonight. Alex, are you out there? Anyway, this is WS2N. No, I don't hear him, but anyway, we'll cover his question anyway, and next week or week after, whenever I hear him again, we'll just repeat the question and answer. He was wondering if we have the capability of nothing to do with the balloon, but actual spy satellites that go overhead. Do we have the capability of either shooting them down or disrupting them in one way or another? And what type of things that we've done in the past, or what could we do in the future? But we actually have the capability. Some years ago, the NRO, I talked about them before, the National Reconnaissance Office, had a very heavy satellite in polar orbit, and this thing weighed 5,000 or 6,000 pounds. Had a couple of thousand pounds of hydrazine fuel on board, and they didn't want that to come through the atmosphere. It's carcinogenic. So they made an arrangement with the military to see if they could shoot this thing down or blow it up in space. You know, this is a little, maybe a, it was late, probably 2027, maybe 2008, 2009, some time frame like that. That's what they did. They sent a missile cruiser ship out to Hawaii, and they have solid booster, solid fueled rockets, missiles, on board on this missile cruiser. And that's what they did. When this satellite was going overhead, they shot this off of a ship straight up and had a perfect hit, blew the thing up. Now, it was in low enough orbit where when it blew up, 99% of the stuff came, able to deorbit within a couple of days. A couple of things went up in the other direction, but they predicted that. And when I say a couple, like a half a dozen pieces went in the wrong direction, but over time it eventually started to deorbit as well. So it was successful. We've done it, and because of our success, naturally Russia thought it was okay for them to do it, and sure enough they did that not too long ago. China also did this as well, but they're a little haphazard in what they did, and the stuff that they blew up is still in orbit and causing problems. One that Russia blew up is every now and then causes problems for the International Space Station, actually has to move out of the way. Any comments? This is WS2N. I haven't heard the diameter of this balloon that was up there. But, we launch balloons on a regular basis, at least 12 or 13, I think, last year. Large balloons, in some cases. We're going to be doing one at the end of the year. When I say we, the United States Jet Propulsion Laboratory is behind it. These balloons are manufactured in Wallops, Virginia, Wallops Island, in that area, sent down to Antarctica. And they plan on launching a telescope. This telescope's got like an 8-foot diameter telescope. It's big. To give you an idea, Hubble is the same kind of diameter. And it's roughly a 5,000-pound thing that they want to put up into the stratosphere, way higher than the 60,000 feet that the Chinese balloon was at. They plan on launching it. They use a balloon as big as, the way they refer to it as big as a football field. So 300 feet probably in diameter is, when it goes up, it expands that big. And it's going to be carrying this 5,000-pound thing. So you can imagine what China must have had on the end of theirs, probably very heavy. And the government didn't want this thing falling down on a Dunkin' Donut or something. Any comments? WS2S. By the way, this telescope is, I want to give the name in case anybody want to look it up. It's the Astrophysics Stratospheric Telescope. Put that into, I guess, Wikipedia, and all this information can come up about it. And it'll be going up. Like I said, the Chinese one was 60,000 feet. This is going to be like 125,000 feet, way up there. And it's, for science. This telescope isn't looking down. It's going to be looking at galaxies. And, they'll be doing more of this now that SOFIE is a 747 that they've canceled that program, which had a similar telescope in the back of the airplane. They used to fly that around, and last year they realized the funding was too much, and that program has been canceled. It's actually cheaper now to continue on with launching telescopes on this balloon, and it'll fly around the continent, Antarctica, and eventually comes back down. And it's not like they're going to throw this telescope away. not going to crash in the ocean. They'll retrieve it and eventually send it back up again. Let me drop it. Okay, nothing heard. Wonder if anybody saw this comet, what I call the green comet, that was a couple of days ago. It's supposed to be you'd be able to see in the northern sky if you look toward Polaris pretty much all night long. Because in that direction, you know, Polaris stays up whole night, whether it's 7 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night or 5 o'clock in the morning. You still look off to the north and you can see Polaris. Anyway, that's the direction where this comet was. I tried, you know, every night. One night I did go out there and, you know, with binoculars, I scanned the sky and I did see, I'm going to call it a star, that was greenish looking. My eyesight's not that good, and if it had a tail, I couldn't figure it out. But it was the only one. There was no other stars in sight, and it was pretty bright. So I'm giving myself probably a 75% chance that I probably saw this thing. Any comments?
WB2BXO.
Frank, how are you?
Okay, Paul, you sound weary. In any case, question about the balloon, and if you've covered it already when I might have stepped away, no need to cover it again. I can always find the recording. It seemed to me like bursting the balloon using an F-22 and a Sidewinder missile was like killing a gnat with an elephant gun. Way overkill. Do we just not have small weapons to deal with small problems? I mean, I'm just kind of wondering about that, Dad.
Yeah, I know they did it with the F-22, a fighter jet, and with a Sidewinder type missile on it. That was shot from that. And to go up there with, you know, I don't know, 50 caliber bullets or something, and deflate it that way, I'm not sure how good that would work. You know, you have to get to 60,000 feet, that jet really has to punch it. He's pretty much going on a pretty straight, not straight up, but, you know, he's going on quite a bit of an angle to get to that height. I don't think they like to loiter at 60,000 feet. The capability of going at 65,000 feet, I believe, on the F-22. I just read that today. So they wanted to really separate it, you know, from, let's call it the gondola, from the balloon itself. And that's what they did. I'm starting to wonder if there was any kind of an explosion from the Sidewinder. Maybe it was a different type of, you know, missile. Maybe something like the one where they killed that guy in a terrorist, you know, where the missile comes flying down from in that case it was a drone, where some kind of a metal came out and just, you know, ripped it apart. I don't know, it didn't look like any kind of big explosion if you've seen it. I'm not sure of the details. You know, they said that they hit it with a missile. But the idea was to bring it down, and that did it, you know. You know, that would be like the fighter pilot's ultimate job, you know. You know, wonder who they gave that to. Don't miss. Back to you, Frank. Question.
It would have been pretty embarrassing for a trained fighter pilot to miss a nearly stationary target with an air-to-air missile. So the guy probably didn't consider it much of a challenge, since he would have been really embarrassed if he or she, I think women are allowed to fly fighter jets now, missed. And no doubt the president will pin some sort of a what on the pilot, which will probably be even more embarrassing for them on what I suspect is a real easy job for somebody performing at that level. Go ahead.
Very good, yeah. I don't know. Anyway, I'm glad they did that. I'm glad they got that. Now they're going to fish it out of the ocean piece by piece. So, you know, when it hits, I guess it's the terminal velocity. You know, even though it's 60,000 feet up, it's going to probably hit at 140 miles an hour. That's my guess. And I believe that's terminal velocity. Anyway, I heard Wesley. Go ahead.
Yeah, my question was, is it supposed to be somehow some sort of mechanism regulating the pressure in the balloon at 60,000 feet? And the balloon had to be humongous. You see the picture, I assume, taken from the ground, from the earth. Although it was quite nice balloon scene. So, the actual physical dimension of it, it's huge. Am I right? And did you hear about some... it must be communication between Chinese and the balloon. At that velocity, at that elevation, it's not a big deal for 1-2 watt transmitter to transmit to China, because it's very high up. Question is, how come it was noticed? How come it was noticed by Americans? Was it because it was so big and it was so high, or was it because of the radio signals? What kind of mechanism is regulating pressure there so it doesn't blow up and the gut doesn't go higher than that?
You know, it says here that these balloons have been floating around for a couple of years.
Okay. Yeah, I heard that, Dave. Like the telescope that's going to be going up in Antarctica. You know, they have, I believe that's the one that has, the capability of taking some of the helium, bringing it back into a tank. So they can change the elevations
complete.
Up and down. Maybe this thing has that capability to do that as well. I don't know. We'll get all the information out later, I'm sure. They said they could direct it, you know, one way or another. You know, I think this thing was going along on the jet stream. Maybe at one point before it got here, China was directing it. I think they, overwhelmed that whole balloon with transmissions in whatever frequencies they were transmitting at or receiving at, so this thing wouldn't get any reception or be able to transmit anything back, you know. I mean, there's been planes flying around that thing the whole time, and my guess is at least one of them was jamming everything that was either, you know, going in or going out of that balloon. Don't know. These are all guesses. Let me drop it.
I assumed that it was some sort of radio communication, and the pressure was regulated probably over the radio. So the balloon electronics was suspended under some kind of drone. I mean, the balloon was acting as a typical drone. Maneuverable, Churchill.
Yeah, well, that's what they said, but I think that all went on before it got over to the Aleutian Islands in Alaska, you know. By the time it got there, I'm sure we had capability of dealing with this thing. And now, on top of that, they said there's other balloons that have gone over the country as well. Even during the last administration. So, you know, if that's true, you know, where did they go? Did it go around the earth again? You know, I don't know. Like Dave said, maybe. the reports will come out. You know, I'm sure when they do come out, frequencies and all that, maybe that's all going to be classified. Oh, I know how we can get classified information. we'll wait until next week. I'm sure Biden will probably make some kind of an announcement either before or maybe during the State of the Union speech next week. Well, we'll see. Anyway, I just wanted to, I'm running out of time. I just wanted to talk about at least one more topic. This is WS2M. NASA has a plan on launching a little lander. It's made by Astrobiotic, and it's called the little lander. It's called the Peregrine, and it's completely built. It's got four legs, ready to fly. It's down in Florida, and all they need to do is complete the preparations on the brand new rocket. Everybody's got a brand new rocket this year, and this one's called the Vulcan. And Vulcan has been under development probably for the last 8 or 9 years. The idea is to replace the Delta IV and the Atlas V rocket, both very reliable rockets. Once this thing is, you know, being manufactured one after the other, it should be able to replace the capability of both those rockets. Now, the Atlas V is, they've launched like almost 100 successful flights, one right after the other. And this thing will have to be just as reliable. It's going to have to be human rated because eventually it will be flying the Starliner by Boeing with crew on board. And someday in the future, it'll also be launching a crew Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser will be cargo at first, and this will eventually be doing that as well. So hopefully, this thing gets off the ground within a couple of months. They plan on launching this as soon as Vulcan is ready. Vulcan has got two new designed engines by Blue Origin. There'll be four engines, so there'll be two of them on the bottom of this rocket. And the inaugural flight, just going to put a mass weight on top. They're going to put this Peregrine lander, which will go to the moon. Scientists weren't really happy where NASA planned on landing Peregrine. The engineers always want to. Let's land in a safe spot. This thing's never been done before with this particular lander. And there's many more landers that are being developed. But they seem very confident, so they said, okay, scientists will agree with you, and they changed the location on the moon where this thing plans, where the plans are to land Peregrine. So hopefully that all goes well. You know, it's always an argument between the scientists and the engineers. I like science, but when it comes to this type of thing, I go with the engineers. Find the safest place to land. I want to make sure all my, you know, everything works. You know, when I go to deorbit, make sure the landing legs work, and you know, hope you know everything works. You just want a safe place to land. But no, the scientists, they want to go to a high hill somewhere or some difficult location with a cliff nearby, so that they could do their geology work, I guess. I'm looking at the time. I got a few other things, but we can get to that next week. No problem there. I'm going to turn it over to Roy. Let me drop it. Thank everybody that asked questions. And, we'll be back next week, hopefully. If you want, you can check into the Club Net tomorrow night, Club Info Net. That's on the news repeaters. But instead of 8 o'clock like this net, it comes on at 8:30. Roy, ACTGS, WS2N, back to you.
Very good. Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net, all that you do with the club. We all appreciate it. I know I appreciate it a great deal. Thanks to everyone who checked in and had something to say tonight. I don't know about you, but I had a fun time. Hopefully you'll join us again next Sunday night when we'll try and do it all over again. Just as a little extra going away present for this episode, I wondered how stupid artificial intelligence could be. So I asked a very popular artificial intelligence graphic software to draw me a picture of a three-element Yagi. And I don't know what the heck this thing is, but it's...